Well, the world we live in can be a very dark place to be. And one of the things that make it so is when people are selfish. Think only of themselves. When someone scratches your car in a car park but doesn't bother to leave a phone number. When you're queuing to buy 6 items at the checkout with twins in tow. And someone else races to get to the belt first with their £200 trolley full. Selfishness. Lovelessness. The Christian message is good news for people who live in a world like this. The Bible reading we had came from a little letter called 1 John, written by one of Jesus' first followers, John, to some Christians in the first century. He tells the good news using language of light and dark. Lovelessness and selfishness are symptoms of the darkness of the world. The arrival of Jesus is like the glow on the horizon when it's nearly dawn. It's getting lighter. And the best bit is that we can be part of this new, lighter world. That, by the way, is one reason why we give a candle when we baptize people. The candle symbolizes light. And baptism symbolizes someone's wish to be a follower of Jesus, to take a step into the light that Jesus brought into the world. And I'd like to point us to 3 things this passage tells us about living in the light. The first is that light comes through knowing Jesus. Light comes through knowing Jesus. Look again, if you would, at verse 7. Beloved, I'm writing you no new commandment, but an old commandment that you had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word that you have heard. At the same time, it is a new commandment I'm writing to you, which is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. It's not new, it's old. It is new. What is he talking about? The commandment he refers to is the instruction Jesus left his first disciples that they should love one another. This is not a new command. It was not new for these Christians because it's part of what Jesus taught several decades before, and it's been part of basic Christian instruction ever since. After all, we're not surprised, are we, to find in our Bibles the command that Christians should love one another. It's not new. It wasn't even new when Jesus first said it. You'll find this in the Old Testament. The book of Leviticus was written 1400 years before Christ. And the command to love each other is in there. On the other hand, Jesus' command was brand new. Because he said this, love one another as I have loved you. He didn't just tell us to love each other. He showed us how. He lived it. He loved us. How did he love us? But if you were here last week, you will remember that we met some of the Bible's teaching on sin. Sin is not just when a few people are unusually naughty, but the attitude we all have, that we are more important than God and more important than other people. Jesus came so that everyone who trusts him can be forgiven for this, so we can be friends with God again. But it cost Jesus his life to give us this. He had to die in our place. That is how much Jesus loved us. He died so that we might be forgiven. And the baptism service is designed to focus our attention on the love that Jesus has shown to us. So the parents and godparents up here, repent of their sins. This is a chance to turn our backs on that rebelliousness towards God. But we don't turn instead to try and be good enough for God to be impressed. Instead, they say, I turn to Christ. And the reason why turning to Christ does any good is spelt out as we declare what we believe. Do you believe and trust in God the Son who died for us? I believe and trust in him. Love one another, said Jesus. And it's a brand new command, as I have loved you. Lots of people have taught about love. Gandhi said that love is the strongest force the world possesses, and yet it is the humblest imaginable. Aristotle said that love is composed of a single soul inhabiting two bodies. Confucius said that it's easy to love, easy to hate, but it's difficult to love. But that's exactly what you would expect, because all good things are difficult to achieve, whereas bad things are very easy to get. Even our own government talks about love. One of the reasons why citizenship should be taught in schools is because democracies depend on citizens who are concerned about the welfare of others. And yet not one of these people has done anything to love us. Gandhi, Confucius, and Aristotle have never given up anything for you. They've never even heard of you. And there are lots of people who have loved you. You've known many good neighbours and friends in your time, and your family make all kinds of sacrifices for you. These new parents will give up all kinds of things for their children. But nobody has ever given up their own life to rescue you from hell for heaven for all eternity. And yet, Jesus has done just that. He's loved us to that extent. And we can love others in the same way as well, because John says this can be true in us as well as in him. When someone turns to follow Jesus, Jesus puts his own spirit in that person so that they can start to be like him, so they can start to love like him, so we can start to live in the light. So the light comes through knowing Jesus. Second, the light is lived by loving Jesus' people. The light is lived by loving Jesus' people. How do you know whether someone is living in the light? How can you tell if someone knows Jesus and has been forgiven by God? They won't have a dinner plate behind their head to tell you that. So how can you tell the difference? You can see it, John says, in the way they relate to other Christians. That's what he means when he's talking about loving his brother or his sister, other Christians. And there are, at the end of the day, two ways we relate to other Christian people. We love them or we hate them. Which is it? Love or hate? Here's a test to see if we really know Jesus. Do we love other Christians in the way that Jesus loved us? Because that's what knowing Jesus looks like in practice. Now, some people might say this is all a bit narrow of John. Why does he talk about loving other Christians? Shouldn't we also love those who don't share our faith? And the answer is, of course we should. It's just not what he's talking about here. John's being far more focused. He has to be for the test to work. He's not asking if you're considerate. He's asking whether you love other Christians precisely because they are Jesus' people. This is a tall order. When you think about the extent of Jesus' love for you, it's no small thing to ask us to show that kind of love for other people. And for this reason, we try to soften the blow. One way we do this is by making this all about feelings. In the West, love is all about how we feel about someone. Feelings have their place. But in terms of whether we're being loving or not, how we feel really is neither here nor there. It's much easier to feel good about someone than it is to really love them. Jesus didn't feel good about us. He surrendered his life for our benefit. Loving other Christians means actually doing things for them, visiting them if they're sick, taking a meal round if they need it, praying for them, picking up the phone to find out how they're doing. These things are a challenge for us because they take up our time. And it means coming to church on a Sunday so that you can see them regularly. It's very hard to love someone if you never see them. The other way we try to soften the blow is by keeping it general. We like to think that John is asking us to love all Christians everywhere. He's not. He's asking you to love the particular Christians you know. This isn't about Christians in general. It's easy to say, I love other Christians, I'd do anything for them. Much harder to love the person in the pew next to you. Actually, it probably isn't the person in the pew next to you that you find hard to love. Otherwise, you wouldn't have sat in that pew. Most of us sit next to people we like. It's more likely to be the person two pews in front that is hard to love. But that's exactly what John called us to do here. Everyone looks nervously to see who is sat two pews behind them. And a bit of casual rearrangement of the seating goes on. Tertullian was a Christian from North Africa at the beginning of the 3rd century. He wrote how the non-Christians of his day could not take their eyes off the way the Christians freely gave money to look after the poor, the destitute, the shipwrecked, and the housebound. He wrote this: "It is mainly the deeds of a love so noble that lead many to put a brand upon us. See, they say, how they love one another." The Christians, he says, had a reputation. They were known for something. They were known for having a love for one another that was unlike the love found anywhere else. Is that the reputation of our church? Ask the people of this area to describe the life of this church. What would they say? Would they say, I tell you what, they really do love each other, and it's like no love I've ever seen? Sadly for many churches, the reputation would be, see how they bicker, not see how they love. There is John's test. How can you tell if someone's been forgiven by God, loved by Jesus, and come to know him? The light is lived by loving Jesus. The third thing to say about the light is this: the light is something to be certain of. Something to be certain of. All this could sound a bit scary. We like the idea of living in the light, but in practice, this means loving other Christians in some fairly committed ways. Can I do it? Would I fail the test? This is why John wrote those last three verses, set out in our Bibles as if they are poetry. He wants us to be sure that we don't work our way into the light by trying to score enough points at being loving. We come into the light as a free gift. We simply choose to entrust Jesus with our lives. So John writes to reassure them. You'll see that in verses 12 to 14, he addresses these Christians as children, as fathers, and as young men. That's a poetic way of saying he's writing to all of them, and never mind for now why he uses those labels. The point is this: he's writing to them as people whose sins have been forgiven. He's writing to them as people who know him who is from the beginning, that is Jesus. He's writing to those who are spiritually strong and so on. He wants us to know that he's not written these few paragraphs to scare us, to make us feel inadequate, to make us give up at ever loving others enough. He's written these paragraphs to reassure us that we are in God's family. And then we'll have the strength to live like we are. We're not meant to be uncertain. Am I in the light or not? Provided you are one of Jesus' followers, some of us here are, he wants you to be certain that you are. Look at your love for other Christians, he says. And then being confident, we can live it out. Imagine being asked to play sport for your country. At one level, it's everyone's dream. Until you start to imagine the pressure. You find yourself on the football pitch to play for England for the first time ever. Am I up to standard? Is this real? Can I do it? Here's a simple test for you. Look at your shirt. What shirt are you wearing? An England shirt. The same shirt that nine other players around you are wearing. If you don't know why I said 9, not 10, ask someone who knows how football works, and they'll explain to you. There's your answer. Someone has given you that shirt to wear. Now, play like someone who's wearing that shirt. So we live in a world that is frequently dark, but Jesus has come and the world is getting brighter. Let me ask you, Where are you in that story? Are you still in the dark, or are you in the light? You can be in the light if you would like to be. Anyone can follow Jesus and know the joy of having their sins forgiven. It's your choice, but it's open to anyone. And if you are in the light, let's live like people who are in the light. Let's live with a growing love for one another.